This week's episode is brought to you by the Digital Promise League of Innovative Schools, a national professional learning network for the most forward-thinking leaders in education. The League is currently accepting applications from innovative, equity-centered school district leaders for its newest cohort. Learn more at digitalpromise.org/league. Hello, welcome to the EdSurge podcast, where every week we look at the future of learning. I'm Jeff Young, a reporter and an editor here at EdSurge. We're a nonprofit newsroom covering innovation in education. A VR experience created by students at the New School in New York City takes viewers to an almond farm in California and illustrates the damaging effects of pesticides on bee colonies. At first, participants wearing a VR headset can walk around the virtual stands of trees and hear the sounds of rustling leaves and buzzing bees. Then, with the push of a button, users can choose a different perspective.
You got to then enter a bee. So you get to become a bee and have kind of like the sense of what happens to the bee colony when the pesticides go all over to protect the trees. And you get to see what it is in the beehive as bee is struggling, kind of actually get to hear and talk to the bee.
That's Maya Georgieva, who runs the New School's Innovation Center. She says the goal of this educational experience is not just to do some virtual field trip to a farm that students might not otherwise get to. It does do that. But the hope is that this immersive technology will also provide a shift of perspective that's just not possible in the physical world. But it's something that can be simulated in a virtual reality space. This is actually a very different vision of VR than we heard hyped by Meta and others that were pushing a metaverse for education just a couple years ago. That vision often imagined whole classes held in VR spaces that looked like replicas of classrooms with desks and whiteboards. But for Maya, the best examples of VR in education are short, intense experiences, like the student project with bees, that can be carefully placed into classroom lessons that happen without a VR headset. In today's episode, we're going to try to dive into where VR can be useful in education. After all, it's still expensive and kind of clunky. So even Maya, who's an enthusiast, says it's just not for everything. This episode is actually part one of a two-part look we're doing on what's up with VR in education after the metaverse hype has died down. For this week, I was excited to catch up with Maya Georgieva, who is a leading voice of where VR is headed. She has actually written some great columns for EdSurge in the past about this topic. I got to sit down with her in person for this one after a talk she gave at the South by Southwest EDU Festival last month. I started by asking her to say more about the center she directs at the New School, which explores not only VR, but extended reality, AI, and quantum computing.
We look into the future of these kind of emerging technology in the context of design, narrative, storytelling, the future of human-computer interaction, and of course, ethics.
Right. No, I want to get to so much of this is exciting. So, okay, so a little over a year ago, there was a lot of talk of the metaverse.
Yes.
Meta changed its name, like Facebook changed its name to Meta and all this stuff. Now it's a lot less. You who watch this space closely, are you surprised a little bit that some of this energy has shifted away from the metaverse these days?
No, I'm not surprised. It's frankly how we engage with technologies. You know, we expect magic, right? Magic to happen. And then kind of we build up an expectation and that as a consequence, a bubble. And now usually we're not ready. We're not ready to get there. Usually we need to actually think deeper and think a lot more about the spaces we'll create, the stories we want to tell, and all this. And so we went into the metaverse kind of in a rush. In a way, when we were actually entering about a decade ago in this whole domain of virtual reality, extended reality, the metaverse was this word where we didn't go for it very quickly. It was also this kind of like space that we knew we were going to go eventually. So then it came in, it caught by fire, but we were not ready. And as a result...
We as a society.
Yes, yes, we were not ready. So as a result, there was like, okay, you know, is this all it is? And so people pulled back. Of course, there's like this whole bubble of crypto that burst a little bit over here in the same space, the NFTs, all of that. So all of these ideas, I think, will continue and we'll have a second read and probably a more successful kind of entry point. But no, I'm not surprised. And as a matter of fact, I oftentimes, I critiqued it a lot. It was more challenging. I also teach immersive, storytelling. So teaching during this hype was challenging because at the same way, the students expected that same kind of entry point, almost instant ready. But it takes hard work to create these spaces still. Now, we have something on the horizon that is exciting about that. But really, I'm so happy that we are in a place where we can actually be engaged in a thoughtful and critical way, and also as creators, because we need to create spaces, we need to create environments and worlds and opportunity for us to connect socially on a number of different levels. And as I often say, spaces that we want to long for to come back. And how would that actually long for to be back?
Yeah.
You know, that will make memories there. Which we will. I'm pretty, certain of that. You know, the lines are blurring. How we make memories, how we meet people, how we fall in love, how we work, play, all these things will be kind of in the intersection of the digital and the physical world. But we still kind of like have this legacy, a number of us, not talking about Gen Z and Alpha, but a number of us still kind of bring in how we experienced media in the past. And so we kind of look at that in a way that is only a sort of what's the difference, or in some ways, is there a difference, or are we actually just replicating spaces? Now, it's very interesting for me to look at the 12-year-olds, the 14-year-olds. What are they doing? How are they perceiving the space? What impact is it on them? And ultimately, like, where they are going to take us to these new spaces. Because we're still mirroring things from the past.
So if I'm hearing you right, you are not necessarily excited about the hype around the metaverse, even though here you were,
yes,
as a technologist, a futurist who was like already, I mean, you and I had already spoken and you've already written for EdSurge about, before this whole hype, about all these technologies and the promises of immersive reality and immersive technology. So, but somehow were you worried that it was, the idea was too much replicating the spaces you and I are sitting in right now? In a way?
Yes. I mean,
metaphorically, I guess?
They are. Yes, indeed. And a little bit of that may stay. Mm-hmm. But a little bit of that, a whole lot of this, I hope, will be reinvented. Mm. We've been reinvented in a way that that these spaces will tap on the affordances they offer us to create, meaning through presence, through different types of agency, and of course, immersion. And of course, embodiment, right? I think the one thing about just kind of sitting in front of a desktop and navigating through the keys, it's not the same. Wearing a heavy headset is not the same. So once all these things, the form factor and everything, develops at the place of a high level of accessibility, comfort level, and also we create opportunities for engagement that perhaps bridge, these worlds. I think that we'll see. I think we'll see a much more kind of meaningful engagement with these worlds.
Yeah, I think like it's interesting because I wonder how much are we. Is it that the technologies also are not ready? You mentioned we're not ready as a society. But is it the form factor? How important to you is it that, like, it's not the bulky experience that it still is, I think? You have better experiences, directly with some of these gadgets. But how important is it to get to something where it's like putting on glasses or just less setup time for people?
I think very important on a number of levels. One, we are very particular in what we put on our faces. So it should be comfortable, right? Even with the latest release of Apple Vision Pro. Mm-hmm. Some of the big critiques, it's heavy. Now I have Apple Vision Pro. I'm very used to, like, I do a lot of things, including play, with a headset on my face. Right. So I don't feel like, so it did encourage a whole new group of people that are putting in the pro and feeling it's heavy. But yeah, I do believe that having to a comfort and accessible level of engagement. I think what makes a difference, for example, what make a difference kind of in the last 2 years, the pass-through. You know, being able to kind of like go from the digital into the physical, you know, and seeing and engaging with that and games or experiences through the pass-through are gaining incredible traction. And this is that idea of mixed reality, spatial computing. The other things that immediately kind of make a difference for people, which is kind of all, you know, around the headset, the interaction with the headset, the kind of new interfaces we can create, it's hand tracking. Mm-hmm. You know, as soon as I see my students love experiences that have hand tracking. As a matter of fact, even really, really good experiences that were being done in the last 2, 3, 5 years, which there are, sometimes they stand out, they're just so confused. Why is there no hand tracking?
So what you mean is like the gestures you make it carries into the virtual world.
Yeah, you no longer have to worry about a controller, which is not intuitive. You know, people who game, it comes easier to them. For everybody else, they kind of have to figure out. You know, you basically have a controller in your hand. With hand tracking, you can kind of reach out and pick an apple. You can reach out and move or interact with an object. One of my favorite things when I go with my students in virtual reality is they love high-fiving each other. Because they get a feedback. And so it's kind of like it's this motion, it's expression that, you know, gets them present. And that kind of translates well. And immediately, like, they're excited about that. Every so often, they kind of take on things that are completely, you know, as I'm trying to, like, you know, get to facilitate the session in virtual worlds, they start playing a TikTok game or sort of some of, you know, let's try rock, paper, scissors, you know, does it work? And so these are the things that, to me, you know, we need more of that. And we need that to happen seamless. And it's starting to happen. So, yes. So
here's my big question about the technology and for education and yes. for any use is it sounds fun. In that demo, and I've seen many demos myself already, but the is it worth it factor, right? Because it's all this technology to have a high five. So what is gained, you know, yes. back to your point about not just replicating what we can do here in person, okay. like what is gained then in like, you know, playing rock, paper, scissors with all these gadgets versus, you know, like without the gadgets?
Well, no. Like, I think that this is important because it gives a social presence. So just think about the hundreds, thousands, if not millions of students who are in online learning, who are, you know, clicking through one video after another at their own space, somewhere completely isolated. And now you can augment that. You know, the first thing about me suggesting to you some of these things matter was, first of all, that we now have an interface that's an affordance that actually enables that in a natural way, using a marker in your hand. Not some sort of like, you know, combination of keys, not a combination of buttons. You use your hand in this world and you're present and co-present with others. So that is just in a context of education, right? It's not, you can move closer to somebody and have a very intimate conversation and then other people can carry on and then you can move around this virtual space and meet others. So it's, education ultimately is a social process. And I start my presentation with something, you know, with back to Dewey, that ultimately learning happens in experience and reflecting on that experience, John Dewey. So, you know, being able to create experiences that are authentic, that are connecting people, that are giving them an opportunity to then step away, think about, is very important. Now, I mentioned these in the social domain, right? We have also a number of now experiences that lead to, can I step into the shoe of somebody, you know, of understanding. And then that's not only to kind of say, I'm a woman, a Caucasian woman, and I want to see how an African-American boy may be kind of entering the world and, you know, faced with what it means for him to secure employment or, you know, what it means for them to navigate the world That is one way, but even more so to check our own bias. It is as much understanding walking in somebody else's shoes as it is to get a feedback in a place where it's safe, in a place where you learn. So there's been a lot of work done in and around these kind of diversity, inclusion, equity conversations, which I think sometimes are personal conversations. And then sometimes you have an opportunity to kind of step back, and you need to talk more about that. See, one of the things that oftentimes I when I kind of talk about these experiences, it's not the 5, 10, 15 minutes on the headset. It's what happens before and what happens after. This just sets the stage for more, you know, for more critique, for more in-depth conversation, for more curiosity. And it oftentimes is something that we observed. So, you know, whether it's actually something about the skill, whether you're going in there and you're figuring out, you know, your first day on a job or in a possible kind of job, and you're figuring out a very complex interface or a very complex space, and, you know, more like skill-based type of simulation. And certainly in the medical field, is in the last 3 years, we've seen a lot more traction in that than other fields. Or it's just that opportunity to come back to something and not read about it, not hear about it, but having experienced it. And so I think that ultimately is one of, you know, the best ways to integrate this. That's why the whole idea of metaverse or other things, I don't believe that we have to spend our days there. No. As a matter of fact, I'm very, very to my own team, to my students, like entering in. It's like, hey, you know, take it in bite size. Spend some time, spend some games, written, you know, kind of move your body, feel your body in the space. Right, we are still in a primitive, we are still in, you know, this is work in progress. Everything from the headset, the worlds, you know, our avatars, how we navigate the world with that avatars. But this is like what we see on the consumer market. And of course, in labs around the country, there are more sophisticated sort of experiences and more advanced, but we need higher level of bandwidth, we need more computing power and all these things, which, you know, it's coming. It's definitely coming our way. But I do want to have this conversation, not in the context that this has any kind of silver bullet moment. No. It's about thinking. It's about learning. How do I design a learning experience that matters, that makes students engage? And, you know, what are ways that they can create in the space? They can, you know, kind of test hypothesis where they can basically pose questions that are different. And think about that future, which, you know, in terms of the context of industry, which is moving. All of the students in my class, majority of them, and I see more and more actually students in their advanced, you know, I'm teaching in the context of the undergraduate experience. So usually this is a great sophomore class, but I see a lot of students taking it in their last semester or taking it in their junior year as a way to inform what they should work on their thesis, on their capstone, thinking about that, kind of having a sense that careers are changing, that industries are changing, and what would be a way that this, you know, can inform something that they bring into their next employer, which is also have changed even in the span of the last, you know, 5 years of introducing this in the higher educational, at least, experience.
After the break, more on that Life of Bees VR project. And we get Maya's take on how AI is changing the VR landscape. Stay with us. Are you an education leader looking to bring innovative approaches to teaching and learning to your school district? Apply to join the Digital Promise League of Innovative Schools, a professional learning network connecting forward-thinking leaders from our nation's public school districts. Together, members become catalysts for change by co-creating research-backed solutions to challenges in education. League leaders are helping to create policy for the safe and ethical use of AI in schools, to prepare diverse students for careers in cybersecurity, and more. If you're an education leader looking for hands-on opportunities to collaborate, connect, and learn alongside a tight-knit community, the League is for you. apply to the newest cohort by May 31st. Visit digitalpromise.org/league today. That's digitalpromise.org/league. Now back to the episode.
You know, I'm curious, I'm sure you've heard this critique too, especially you mentioned DEI and like the power of like putting you in another's shoes. Like, is there a danger that it could sort of be, give someone a false sense that they're embodying something that you can't possibly experience? Like, I can't possibly know what it is to be a woman walking around in the world or whatever, or vice versa. Like, but if I did a 15-minute experience, is there any risk that someone would feel overconfident that they've experienced something that you can't experience?
Yes, you. That's a really important question. I'm so glad that you asked that question. So this is the thing, and I don't use or very kind of thoughtfully use the word empathy, because it is, it is kind of taken, particularly in this context of immersion, has been a little bit taken out of context often, right? So I think as you are on the headset and you're experiencing something like that, you indeed can be, it is a huge emotional pull in this technology, because you're present, and frankly, there's no feed of desktops and browsers, so you do feel more empathetic. So you can.
Interesting. It's interesting that the headset has the benefit of not having my phone like buzz around me or the email pop up.
Yeah, it's interesting. Some of my students actually referred to that as, they said, like, it actually makes me feel calm. Whoa. Because they put on the headset and they kind of, you are teleported someplace. And at the moment, at least, you don't have competing screens. You usually kind of teleport to a place for a reason. So it's kind of interesting, yeah, another layer. But in terms of the, back to our conversation about empathy. So I think in the experience, you are likely to actually experience a high level of emotional, whether it's connection or empathy to somebody else's experience. However, that doesn't mean that when you take off the headset, that stays there. What we aim to stay there is that criticality and your intent to learn more or to ask better questions. So I usually don't rely on this empathy translating, in an instant. However, it does provide a first-person experience, and I navigate this very carefully. But certainly, as I said, very cautious when we kind of directly go, this is kind of like an empathy machine. I think what it is that it has a huge emotional power.
Now, I wanted to ask you about AI, because that is where the tech talk is these days. And I noticed that at your talk here at South By, you link immersive and AI and the making of immersive reality. So can you talk about, it sounds like you're seeing an intersection between AI and VR. Can you talk about that?
Yes. Not only that, 2017, my talk at South by South was called The Conversion of XR and AI. And I showed very limited things at the time. But I've definitely been watching, very much kind of watching for this moment to arrive. And yes, we are now in the context of that we have, XR basically being the interface and AI being the agent behind it. In the context of learning, or just really it's a powerful force that is kind of reshaping the landscape. So usually when we thought of like these experiences, it was kind of like required of, even though we wanted them personal, we wanted them to be interactive, we wanted them to be nonlinear or explore different scenarios or all these kind of more like on-demand approaches, right? Experience on demand, to quote here, like Jeremy Bailenson. But that would actually require a huge amount of work behind these experiences. Yeah. And it still very much was scripted, right? Like a game, you can pursue different scenarios and different outcomes, but it was scripted, right? We kind of storyboarded narrative. Now, in that conversion of AI and XR, and I'm kind of put this more in the storytelling and educational context, now we can actually address a number of, like, a much higher level of, you know, customization and tailored experience to where people are, you know, where if you're a student or whether you're entering there for whatever reason to learn. So, you know, this is of course really interesting, you know, to the context of just AI is all about data, but it's all about data and understanding about ourselves, right? Whether it's going, this AI agent will kind of materialize to a hologram or to a browser. It's all about the data. And sometimes, depending on what they know about us, they may know a whole lot better and more analytical than a teacher or even a parent can kind of see instantly. And so, you know, in that kind of tailoring, this is these kind of learning experiences or experiences, it becomes really possible. Now, with all of that, there's always the critical question, the ethical question about data, the ethical question about, how an AI agent, you know, acting as a coach or as a mentor or in that as a teacher, even in some instances, you know, what that experience is like. We have some examples, limited examples from the past when we've tried to do that, even with Watson, IBM Watson, and others. But right now, you know, these large language models, like that game has changed. And it will continue to change. And my talk here was really focusing on that, you know, the intersection between AI and XR and the making of this new immersive reality, and also sort of that creative frontier that we experience, and putting a spotlight on that idea of next generation creators and, thinking about, usually, you know, as we are, artists, creators are very good with metaphors, and hence my entry point in this field all the way in back from the context of storytelling. Because, you know, this is how we can create metaphors, and because oftentimes this is really about emerging practice. So, the best part of my job is that I get to create and, you know, it's kind of you are in the context of creating practice. You're trying things and my students would all the times are prototyping and that's kind of how we learn. That's how I learn and by kind of my team as well.
Can you give an example of a student project? I know you demoed some here.
Yeah.
Or can you just describe it for us? And because we're in audio here and these are so visual, but I know you can do it. Like to describe like what one of these examples of what a student came up with or student team or I don't know, you know, or and like what it is and how it turned out.
Yeah, so students have a completely kind of open canvas in terms of what they might end up working on. But I am going to give the spotlight to one of my students, Julia Dasser, and she was in the last year immersive storytelling course, and she worked on a project with four other members of the class, so they are usually in teams of five, because I do believe that actually when you sit on the table beyond school, like it's a team of creatives coming from different intersections and bringing different ideas as well as different skill set, different knowledge to kind of that creative table. But this definitely was Julia's kind of idea, the original idea. And so she was really interested in the context of climate change and the environment. And she teleports you as you enter the experience into actually Southern California on a almond tree farm. And you kind of get almond farm. Yeah. And you get to a kind of walk the farm and see the almond trees and kind of see the farm, get a message. And you first embody the kind of the farmer that obviously is interested in, you know, protecting the trees. So they're using pesticides. There are all kinds of things, you know, and it's another hot day. Of course, kind of you're entering this space and you can walk around. But what you also see there is a number of beehives that are also kind of coexisting with the almond trees, except that these pesticides have a huge impact on the bee population. So as you're experiencing this and this morning in California and on the farm, you get to then enter a bee. So you get to become a bee. And have kind of like the sense of what happens to the bee colony when the pesticides go all over to protect the trees. And you get to see what it is in the beehive as bee is struggling, kind of actually get to hear and talk to the bee. So this is the kind of experience that they create, and it's really embodying, you know, sort of this moment that we're living, of climate change, some of the choices we make, how we actually appreciate some and not, and, you know, take actions that may have a very controversial or, you know, different, you know, impact on different species. So yeah, this is one of the experience that I briefly featured yesterday.
That's so interesting. And so that's another example of, it's not just a virtual field trip where, you know, if you could go to the almond farm, that'd be nice, but we'll just like curate it for you and put it on rails. So you you get to become the bee.
Yes, you get to embody the bee and fly and then meet your other bees and kind of go back into the hive and see the impact and what, you know, these pesticides really have a really negative impact on the bees. And so see some of the bees that are suffering and ultimately, lowering the population. And as you know, there is kind of like a worldwide, it's known that the population of bees is dropping worldwide. So that was some of the context. But, you know, through this experience, you get to see different perspective. And also you get to be in the natural environment. So, yes, these are the kinds of projects that, you know, make me really excited, because the students are then thinking on a system level approach. And it's not just, it's a game, just kind of like a cool game. And, you know, we do get some cool games, and there's nothing, I actually think there's nothing bad with that, because, you know, games have a number of different positive impact, but this idea of creating and thinking on that level approach and thinking, well, how do I actually create something that I can present my argument in a way is that somebody can be, you know, walk away and be compelled to tell that story to somebody else.
Yeah, interesting. And so it's a next level of, and it gets an empathy, I suppose, too.
Yeah, as I said, and it is mental. I think inside you... I would vote very high that many of us would experience a high level of engagement, empathy, emotional, kind of some kind of emotional impact. It is kind of when we take this experience, now that it is ours, that we witness that, or we were part of it.
Except for it's not real.
Honestly, I don't think that matters that much. Huh. I actually think that when this is done right, you understand that impact of the bee. When you see a negative, when you see a behavior in virtual worlds that doesn't translate well in the physical world, you noticed. Students are very, very observant. And, you know, again, like we have to also think of we have students right now that soon enough, they would not remember a world without virtual reality. Just as, you know, we're talking a lot about, the iPhone came in 2007. It's, you know, how many people think about it, that it arrived in 2007?
That there was a world before it.
Before.
Yeah. No, it's true. My kids don't really believe me that there was a time like that, I think. So you mentioned at the end of your talk here that this is a social justice conversation.
Mm.
Tell me more about that. How is all this, you know, gadgets and sure, empathy and teaching, but how is it a social justice conversation to talk about these issues?
Right. I mean, so when, in summary, like I showed a number of different examples, and in the context of creators, in the context of, you know, the next generation, when you think about it, last year we kind of woke up and it was a year just talking about ChatGPT and large language models and everything.
14 months talking about ChatGPT.
Right. And there are people on all kinds of different camps, and people at this point that even a little kind of have a fatigue from this conversation. I'm also like in a large university, so you know, you see a number of different sort of perspectives and a number of different takes on this. But what's changing this year and what we're going to talk a lot more about this year, and that's where I kind of I took off in my talk in, you know, very from the beginning, is multimodal. Is the idea that we were talking about text-to-text a lot last year, and everybody's very, very concerned, our student reading, our student writing, who's writing, the whole notion of academic integrity, how we actually assess that, well, is there a way to detect that, and all this conversation. But the game is honestly quickly changing. Now we're going from text to sound, from text to character, from text to scenario, from text to world, and from text to ultimately virtual world and virtual experience.
And, so and we're seeing these headlines, you know, you go over them in your talk, I think, but we're seeing already the, you know, the Taylor Swift videos that are not her and that are sometimes that are disturbing. There are others that are, you know, like deep fakes around politics that are visual, sometimes video, sometimes audio, sometimes a mix. And that's what you're talking about, multimodal.
Yeah, and so the multimodal, like, you know, it's accelerating this. And we're so not well equipped to looking at these deepfakes or even looking at that content. Now, when I look at content from Midjourney, I can spot it instantly. I do a lot of that. I create. But if you just see it, if somebody else who's not as involved or highly involved in these fields, they may just see an illustration.
Yeah.
A very interesting illustration. So my students refer to those as, you know, these are all, you know, just, they're like, they have no emotion, no human touch. All I create is something that I've experienced. It's part of how I, you know, create a drawing. Midjourney can kind of, in seconds, create instantly all of these.
This tool, Midjourney, that describe it for people.
Visual. Yeah, so you can, through a text prompt, you can create an image. But then you can be very specific. You can create a cinematic image. You can create an illustration, an anime.
Genre, you tell
yes.
Whatever, yeah.
Yeah, and it arrives in seconds, and then you can continue to kind of reiterate on it. And some of them, of course, include people and places, and it's so cinematic. And that has translated now from images to video. Of course, videos are really short. We're not talking about a full-featured movie. You know, something akin to a trailer. And they could be so cinematic. And I showed some example yesterday, and those, you know, people who follow, they, you know, of Pika and then Sora, which OpenAI has kind of showcased as a prototype, only a small segment of developers have access to it at this point, but is being slated to arrive in sometime in 2024, probably for the premiums. And this customers, and this brings us to the social justice moment, right? So you start looking around and you start looking, seeing a lot of paywalls. So what happens? Institutions, not every institution will be able to afford to now offer. And there may be very multiple perspective on should we offer, you know, free access to large language models, and are we offering everything from text, image, video? Like how, you know, that leads to a lot of pedagogy and academical questions. And I addressed a little bit about that because there has to be a pedagogical shift. I'm on the camp that we need to engage with it and we need to explore it. Our students will actually develop literacy not by seeing, by sending, by not using it and sitting on the sidelines, but actually understanding its potential and limitations. So that's one. So it has to be critical engagement. Accessibility and inclusion, again, very, at the moment, spotty. It's through a browser, it's text-based. It addresses, you know, it can be addressed, some of the conventional things we do for certain accessibility. But again, that's kind of usually covers part of the spectrum of abilities. So the ethical questions, right? And that's the ethical questions are so complex. And people sometimes step in and step out because they're just completely, I think, surprised in a way and shocked maybe even more so by the complexity. Yes, overwhelmed is a good word. So what happens, right? These large language models are kind of created by getting all data from I mean, I've written a whole lot of articles. It's RON. Nobody asked me, but I'm, you know, the New York Times, right? They have the court case of asking OpenAI to basically remove that content. We'll see how that goes.
Right.
But,
they
you know, all of us, right. All of us have content on the web, yourself included, videos, writing, all of this is in. It's in the model. So,
in other words, the ChatGPT and others have been trained on this data that you and I wrote that we've not been copied.
Yes. And so now it's kind of when it looks at, it sampled us without we've never ever given any kind of acceptance or any even waiver or ask for it. So when you think about this is in the context of all human kind of creativity, whether it's art, whether it's movies, whether it's, you know, all kinds of things, it's been now sampled. And in some respect, we are actually taking advantage of it. We also, like, as users are taking advantage of it, right? And it's not like we're looking at the filters which we used to have. Oh, just style something as Van Gogh or Picasso, which is recognizable, and now it's 2 centuries, you know, later, it's completely different. But what happens to the young artist, the young professionals that just created something, and now, you know, how do they go about that? So there's two sides of it, and one is the whole idea about intellectual property, about copyright, and how that their concerns about, you know, how AI is being trained, and all the, you know, younger generation of artists and illustrators, and how do they obtain an IP?
Yeah.
And actually, the other part about, you know, at the same time, I have students who perhaps never were interested in drawing something, but had great ideas. And now they have a tool at their disposal when they act on these ideas and then can create a game just by co-creating with generative AI. And that's exciting. I use it a lot in my work. It accelerates a lot of the things I do. It's very good with unstructured data and, you know, teaching, you get a lot of unstructured data, so it's amazing. You know, sometimes I've done, you know, if you do some, you know, if you're looking at educational data or something, and I've been amazed myself at what I can do. Usually that work, I have a research assistant or somebody else, and now from 10 to 10:30, I can do it and have a bowl of ice cream and pretty much feel like incredible. So there's these things right there. But the social justice is, we need to critically, you know, assess that AI's role. Regulation may be coming, but it's going to be a while. People are pledging things, but, you know, we are now in our election season, but it's not just U.S., it's Europe. It's something like 65 countries in the world are in election seasons. Half of the world population, I think, in some kind of rough estimate, deepfakes. I mean, huge impact on our political discourse because these deepfakes or even an image, but if you spend the time to look at once, twice, three times, by the third time, our human eye will start detecting things. If you're a little bit more kind of tuned in, as I am, you may start spotting them on one or two, but so you're equipped. And of course, you believe, you know, you read it. It is in your face, in your kind of brain.
You feel like you're experiencing.
Yeah, and you feel like that person said that.
Right, or you're hearing it.
You know, right. Seeing is believing. Like we have these, like even sayings, a picture is 1,000 words. Like, and now that's challenged. That's just challenged, and we have to really kind of think about that. But then it creates these pockets of the paywall, the entry point, it enables some, it may be not, it may have a really huge impact on others, on their livelihoods. You know, in terms of the labor market, there are so many different provocative ideas, and, you know, some people are in the context of if it's going to have huge, people lose their jobs, other people are like, maybe there'll be, net, maybe there will be new jobs created. Look, there will be a change in the labor market. And that is, again, seen even like as a glimpse of that. So there's various, you know, we've seen kind of this take on the gig economy, and a lot of that, this variety of websites. And what is observable now that the low-stakes type of projects, which are usually more geared to a young professional, a student, they're more like an internship, or those are disappearing. You see an appearing of high-stakes projects, but usually that means a professional with 10-plus years of experience. That's great. But what happens? What happens to these generation that is graduating last year, this year, next year, and there's no opportunity for them to enter and learn and do more?
You even mentioned that you might have, in the past, used a research assistant, and now you can just sit there with your computer in the morning or whatever. And that's a little bit terrifying. How does the next generation, you know, at some point with even like podcasting, I used to be terrible at editing. It used to take me forever. It seems like now the tools are just going to be able to do some of the things that I do. So it seems like it's come for us information workers.
Yes. So it's very important, and I do a lot of that. And I think sometimes even my students or like my team is a little bit surprised. But what our best wisdom is to that next generation is sharing process and sharing practice. So in a way, actually going through the mental practice I have in making like decision or thinking through a prototype or thinking to the efficacy of a prototype. And so that these are the conversations that are ultimately the most important ones. Everything else is available, readily available, but spending time with another human being in the context of a face-to-face or some kind of social experience in the future, because it's going, you know, these holographic experiences of us with others, that's coming. Qualcomm is working on that. So, but, you know, having that, the conversation, the context of the conversation being processed, that ultimately I think is very, that's going to be very important in how people cope, in how people thrive. And in that conversation, if it's done right, it's all about empowering. It's all about encouraging. It's all about, you know, driving and inspiring people to do more and to want to do more. And so I think that's the future of education. That's, you know, having these conversation of, you know, somebody who's like 20 years down the road and you've tried different things and you've learned from them and you failed because that's how you learn. And being able to empower somebody else to just keep, you know, walk that path and that they're going to fail but learn and sharing these kind of examples that are personal examples. And I think that's the role of the teacher in the future. It's going to move away from this is intro 101. This is how it does. A lot of that can be augmented. And a lot of that can be augmented by, you know, AI agents.
Taught by a hologram?
Yes. Or why not? You know, if you want to be taught by Einstein, you probably could be in the future or somebody else. And
for the 101.
Well, I don't think it will matter. If that's where you start, if that's what will inspire you, why not? But I think that conversation with somebody reflecting on and sharing wisdom is unique. And it can this be tuned in other ways? And possibly, I'm not gonna say no, possibly, because it's all about the data. So, you know, can this be captured and possibly in some future moment in time? But I do think that in general, moving away from sitting up in front of 25 or 100 or 200 students and going about, you know, just kind of introducing content, very procedural sort of in our disciplines. And it's going to be all about that conversation with a student. Definitely moving more in the coaching and mentoring space. It will be still about the discipline. I mean, we ultimately know a lot about the things we do, right? And the things we, it's impossible to follow through in everything. And so all of us know a lot about our fields, know about, you know, the artists, the designers, the engineers in our fields that have done, you know, amazing work, that have done work that is exceptional and groundbreaking. And if you are 15, 18, 21, you may or may not have encountered that work. And now you have somebody to say, hey, you should look into that. And that's our role. You should test this. And students come with great ideas, and that's kind of how I started this talk, because ultimately it was also about creativity. And, you know, we value, as human beings, we value creativity so much, this idea, the ability to generate novel ideas and valuable ideas. But all this is a process of discovering, of making new connections, of seeking new perspectives, and kind of thinking about ways to connect things outside of their boundaries. As I ask my students, work on the edge of the genres. That's when things get interesting in the context of storytelling. But so that is us as teachers or, you know, mentors, in that is the ability to able to point, to suggest when we hear these ideas our students bring to us. And that is the process of creativity. It's not something you just kind of wake up and you have a good idea, but to shape that idea, it takes a lot of discovery, problem solving, kind of expanding the possibilities, and kind of creating a whole new space maybe, or a whole new genre, which I'm sure our students will do.
Oh, that's great. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to share this today. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's great seeing you here. And it's lovely to be able to have this conversation with you.
On next week's episode, we're going to look at what happened to a college that did create a virtual replica of its campus in VR and dig in more to what happened to this idea of a metaverse for education. This has been the EdSurge Podcast. If you like the show, first of all, thank you so much. We really appreciate you being part of this. Please take a minute to give us a review or a rating on whatever podcast app you're using right now. This episode was put together by me, Jeff Young. You can find me on X at JR Young or on the web at jeffyoung.net. Editing this episode by Rebecca Koenig, and the music is by Komaku. Of course, we'll be back next week with more on the future of learning. Thanks for listening.